like a splinter or a thorn. Yesterday, Murshid Anayakhan gave this example of thorns. And, you know, we all have them. So this breath is kind of can extract those splinters or thorns and create the resurrection. The crown of thorns. We have to surrender this coconut, this thinking mind, this intellect, this one that thinks that it knows, the coconut, the crown of thorns, to the divine resurrection, the Baka, the fauna and the Baka, the horizontal and the vertical lines, in case anyone wants to think about that. The training of the ego, what the ego needs and what it does not need. In order to train the ego, it is necessary that one should distinguish what is the right of the ego and what is not its right. So even that rascal has some rights too. The ego has a tendency to want what it needs and also what it does not need. So what are some things that we think the ego might need? Food. Oh, yes. That might be what it doesn't need. It's what it wants. It's what it wants. There's a great Lojong teaching, you know, training of the mind, where it says to take both praise and blame in the same way, you know, neither praise nor blame. It's a very hard thing. Such a hard thing to do. It's a good thing. Because sometimes, you know, when people are blaming us, it's just really a reflection of something that's arising in them. It doesn't have anything to do with us, and we don't need to connect with it. An example can be, I'll tell you this because I think it might be helpful. It's also revealing of my own personal nature, which probably isn't any mystery to anyone. It's very, I hope, very transparent. But I was on, you know, I was nominated and awarded a Fulbright scholar to scholar post to Morocco a few years ago, and I traveled with a number of other scholars from different disciplines. So there were sociologists and linguists, and of course I was a visual artist, and there were philosophers and anthropologists and so forth. And I was very aware from the very beginning, as we started to do training in preparation for this trip. In fact, I told the coordinator of the journey that I felt that if it couldn't be understood that I am experiential where others' disciplines are observational, that I could view that as being problematic, that my energy within the group could be problematic, because I'm very up close and personal about stuff. I mean, you are as an artist or a designer. And I didn't feel that I was going to be going to a zoo to observe people. I wanted to experience them and be close. And I just knew intuitively, having traveled in other areas, and especially troubled areas, there's often this effort to corral people and kind of control what they see and what they do. And of course, you know, as soon as I got there, I felt that. And so then I started scheming into how to escape, you know. So there was a vibration put into that made people feel that I really didn't want to be part of the group because, well, I didn't really want to be part of the group. So. So, and everyone was very tolerant and kind, but I just kind of preferred to not do that and be in that insular situation. I wanted to, like, go talk to people and meet them and be with them and, you know, like, be in that vibration. And so at the end, you know, I thanked the person for all their efforts because I really did appreciate everything that he did. I mean, you can't imagine, you know, his coordination with the Fulbright Foundation. And I mean, can you imagine 5 weeks at the best of the best places and traveling from north to south, east and west, all paid for, no penny from one's own pocket? It was a great gift. And I felt like the body of work that I did, I'm very proud of from that experience. And in the end, we were kind of having a closing evening. And I went up and I said, I really want to thank you. I know it hasn't been without its problems. And I really apologize to any grief I've caused you. And, you know, and it was like all of this stuff. And he looked at me and he said, "You are the most arrogant, egotistical person I know." And it really surprises me because, of course, I teach meditation and I do all this stuff. And I looked at him and I said, "I really want to thank you for sharing that. And I know that's your truth about me, but I have to say, you have to put it out there. And I'm listening, but I don't have to accept it." And it totally dissipated. And he just hugged me. And we're friends. But it was like, from his point of view, I can totally understand why he said that. And probably all along he was just thinking, well, she's so ungrateful, you know. I can understand that. But it wasn't my intention. You know, there was nothing in me that had to rise up to meet that. You understand what I'm saying? So someone can say a really harsh thing to you, but if it just, like, then you know. You have to be present for that person, but maybe it's really not about you. It's just, that was an energy. He was probably ready to pop me all along, you know? And it was good that he got that off of his chest. Very healthy. You know, and I just kind of looked, and I did say, I'm glad you felt you could say that. That shows a depth of friendship and integrity of your being. And, you know, I just kind of looked at him, and I just said, "I really love you, and I really appreciate everything you've done." You know, it just kind of made it all okay. It let him have the space to release that energy, and it made me know that I knew, honestly, that was not my intention. Now, if something had arisen where I felt I needed to justify myself, I think I would have then known that there was something in that for me, too. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's good. And that's not to say that something doesn't happen that doesn't trigger something. Alhamdulillah. Praise God. You know, oh, there's the work to be done. It's very good for us. So so again, the question was what the ego needs. Food is one, of course. Appropriate clothing to protect our bodies, you know, from the sun or from the cold. Shelter appropriately. A way to get from here to there to meet our responsibilities. These are things that we need. There's no shame in that. So the first is a natural appetite, and the second is greed. This is like the nature of the dog that, after eating the flesh off a bone, still guards the bone against another dog. Yeah. Right? I've even heard some people that they've moved from a house or something, and then they go back and look at the house, and it's like, oh my God, those people have just done such trash with that house, right? Why? It's their house, you know? Or we do that with people too. I mean, I really see that, like people that maybe have even gone through a divorce, if the other partner finds a happy marriage, it's like, they're so resentful and they make so many problems. It's like, what are they, guarding the bone? Besides this, the ego has a tendency to want more and more of what it likes. More brown. crannies, right? Regardless of right and justice. Also regardless of after effect. More oil. More space. For instance, a person may eat and drink more and more until it makes him sick. Every kind of gratification of desire or appetite gives a tendency to want more and more. Then there is the desire for change of experience. I read this and I thought, this is the change of experience that we can control, because we really don't like change that other people are controlling in our lives. This is, oh, I want a new outfit, I want a new car, I want a new house. Like that, it makes us, gratifies the ego. And when a person gives into it, it never ends. Excessive desire in appetites or passions always produces an intoxication in man. It increases to such an extent that the limited means that man has become insufficient to gratify his desires. So then we have to start mapping on to other people and things and experiences to gratify that. It's really, we all know that. Maybe not now, maybe we've come past that, but it can happen. Therefore, naturally to satisfy his desires, he wants more and more of what is his own and wants what belongs to other people. When this begins, naturally injustice begins. Then he cannot get what he wants. Then there is pain and disappointment. When one person gratifies his desire more than other people, the others who see this want to take away the gratification he has. One naturally expects a thinker to understand this and to relieve his ego of all that is unnecessary. I can tell you, I think this also becomes very subtle. I think that sometimes it's interesting. Try this. Even walking on the path, do we always wait to see what the natural impulse of that moment is to either engage or not be engaged as we pass someone? That too can be a gratification of our own ego. At a very subtle level, like, hi, how are you? Do you know I'm here? Kind of thing. I mean, it's a subtle internal thing. It would be good if we could take one day in these camps to have silence and just communicate more subtly with each other, just with the glance, gesture. Beautiful. How beautiful that could be. The training of the ego is this: to eat to live and not to live to eat. To eat to live, not to live to eat. And so with many things one desires. The nature of desires, I have a person, a friend of mine that works with people that have eating disorders and issues around food, which I don't know. I was raised Italian, so food was a big part of our culture and how we celebrated and how we communicated and how we were together. And, so food is really important. And, with other things that could be addictions, you quit smoking cigarettes or you quit drinking liquor, but you can't quit eating food. I mean, that's a real deal, right? And I know for myself, I kind of think about it, I guess men think about sex all the time. I think about food all the time, What's our next, we're eating one meal in Italy. It's where are we going to go for lunch, we're eating lunch. Where are we going to go for dinner, It's and I look forward to it all day. So, it can be a real thing, and I enjoy it. So, but she said to me that it was really interesting when she's working with people that, and I also know that you can change your mind about that. I mean, I've also been able to do that some. I have to watch it, too. It's what's that inclination to feed something, maybe. that's not getting fed in other ways, or to soothe myself, you know. Macaroni and cheese makes me feel good, you know. They're those comfort foods, right? Cinnamon honey buns, like my mom used to make. Okay, so, and it just makes you feel good, like it's a, I deserve that sometimes, but not all the time. That's kind of what's going on here. So, but she said that one of the things that they would do is they would put food before people, and it was so hard for them to not just immediately jump on that food. Like, just that little space to say some grace was extremely difficult, you know? So we want to pray for ourselves and others that are dealing with these appetites. And we all have appetites in some way. It may not be around food. It's in some other way. But Murshid gives the example here. The training of the ego is this: to eat to live and not live to eat. And so with many things one desires. The nature of desires is such that nothing will satisfy it forever, and sometimes the pleasure of a moment costs more than it's worth. And when one's eyes are closed to this, one takes the momentary pleasure regardless of what will come after. The training of the ego is not necessarily a sad life of renunciation, nor is it necessarily the life of a hermit. The training is to be wise in life and to understand what we desire and why we desire it, and what effect will follow, and what we can afford and what we cannot afford. It is also to understand desire from the point of view of justice, to know whether it is right and just. If the ego is given way, to, in the very least, in the excess of desires, it becomes master of oneself. Therefore, in training the ego, even the slightest thing must be avoided, which in time may master us. So any kind of obsessive thought or attachment to having these things work out in a certain way, you know, like this kind of thing, Dalai Lama might say it, that those things that make us unhappy are often unwholesome, and things that make us and others happy are wholesome. So when one is feeling unhappiness, what is that an indication of? It's telling us something. Maybe we have to make a real inner change or some sort of outer change to make things. It's not easy, is it? Sometimes it takes real strength and will to do that, and that's what we're talking about here. Mastery through accomplishment. Mastery through accomplishment. And what do they say? A journey of 1,000 miles begins with one single step. Not like, oh, I'll do that in the future, or I'll take that up, or I'll accomplish that later. It's like, today I do this much. Tomorrow I do this much again. And you keep going towards that goal. Therefore, in the training of the ego, even the slightest thing must be avoided, which may in time master us. The ideal life is a life of balance, not necessarily the life of renunciation. Renunciation must not be practiced for the sake of renunciation. We see that too. And Ram Dass, I love what Ram Dass says about that. He says, really? Renunciation? Let me tell you, you gotta be somebody before you can be nobody. Renunciation must not be practiced for the sake of renunciation, but it must be practiced if it is necessary for balance. Verily, balance is the ideal of life. Balance is the ideal of life. Well, I had hoped to read another Jataka tale. We have 10 minutes here. not sure if I have enough time. It's a long one. I guess I could do it. Okay. Because the next class really begins at 4:15, is that right?
4:04.
Oh, it does? Oh, well, we don't have time. Buy the book. I make no money off of it. I don't have any of those books, but they can be had, you know, through Amazon. I want to read this one thing through, I think the Sufi movement maybe on their website does, but I think they're easily found. I really wanted to share this last note since we've been blessed with Murshid Hazrat Inayat Khan's teachings, Pira Murshid Hazrat Inayat Khan, and here's a wonderful image of him. We're about to republish this book. This is called Once Upon a Time, Early Day Stories About My Beloved Mother and Father by Hidayat Inayat Khan. And I want to thank Rahim because he took the book and retyped all this because we didn't have a digital transcript. So he did that after last summer, our summer school here, our spring camp. Well, you can keep that book, but in truth, that is Kabria's book. Mine, I couldn't bear to part with mine. Mine was signed by Murshid Hidayat and has this little note from him in it with these little hearts that he and Aziza drew. So I thought I should probably keep this one. So she willingly sent hers, and I have to replace it. But I think that that's quite fine if you want to keep it. I'll replace hers because you earned it. And Murshid Hidayat is extremely grateful. So now I have to find that picture again. So look at him, how distinguished he is, huh? Okay. Murshid's majestic personality. Murshid was also like a father to some of his disciples. To others, he was the Murshid, the spiritual guide. But all, whether consciously or unconsciously, responded to the breath of the message, in quotes, as symbolized by Murshid's sublime radiance. His approach was with a smile. His words communicated happiness. His piercing glance was like a torch in the darkness. His loving presence was ever uplifting. Murshid used to say, "I don't want to ever see my murids having a long face. In fact, it is really impossible for anyone to have a long face in Murshid's presence for longer than a few moments." Murshid would always turn an imaginary tragedy into a comedy. But he also saw the tragic side of an apparent comedy. One could best illustrate Murshid's loving personality as being a living example of tremendous intensity in all aspects of human expression, of nobility and majesty. Murshid often went for a short walk around the block, dressed very characteristically in a long black cloak and with a kingly topi, this little top hat, which Murshid Hidayat tells me that his mother, Purani Amina Begum, used to make these hats for Murshid. She used to felt them and make them. Murshid did you see this picture, Musa?
Well, I can't.
Okay. Oh, well, you can look later. You can look later. Murshid often went for short walks around the block, dressed very characteristically in a long black cloak and with a kingly topi on his head. And he also carried a walking stick with a very beautiful silver handle. And his black shoes were always spotlessly polished. Murshid's topi, as he called it, was specially made for him by our mother, according to the design which he made himself, a cross model between the very noble Persian hat and the real old aristocratic Russian one, which had very much impressed him during his visit to Moscow, where our sister Nurunnisa was born before the World War. That's how they got out, you know, when they closed Russia, they wouldn't let people cross the borders. And Noor Nisa's mother, Pirani Amina Begum, hailed her up and said, please let us be free. I mean, she began and ended her life with liberty. Noor Nisa did. That was her last word as they shot her in the head. Liberty! Murshid Shirvani, or Indian costume, was also specifically made for him by my mother. It was a cross model between the Indian and Russian traditions. You hearing that? Which Murshid also designed himself. It was black like the topi, buttoned all the way down on the right side with a high collar and a pleated robe around the waist, ending with tassels on both sides. Murshid's majestic appearance impressed so much the people of Suresnes in France that they used to stop in the streets to salute him, thinking that he was a king. When he entered the tram, everyone stood up, offering most respectfully their seat. Wherever he went, people called him the king. O thou, who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness. Teach us thy loving forgiveness. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide. Send us the peace of thy divine spirit and unite us all in thy perfect being. You can do it at the same time. Sufis do that.
Not both left and right.
No. But we're doing it with the left and the right sides. Yeah. Okay. Very beautiful. Have you all been kissed? One more. Now it's done. Is the circle closed? All right, now we've done it. Well, as Murshida Vera would say, Allah bless. Yafata on the next steps on your journey until we meet again in the circle in the fall, inshallah. God bless. May this benefit spread in all directions for the benefit of all beings. Thank you.